Today we have a fair amount of ground to cover. The impeccability of Christ, then some aberrant views, states of Christ, and perhaps touch on kenosis. We are on page 5 of the brochure, Christ's Temptability and Peccability. Well, actually, page 4. Page 4. The question is, was Christ tempted? Now, there are two meanings of tempted. One is tested to show the genuineness of one's faith or one's character. The other is enticed and solicited to moral evil. Was Christ tempted? It would appear that both meanings are true in his case, that he was tempted in both senses. And then, harking back to the elements of temptation sequence, that page, the question whether he really felt these temptations, whether he really struggled. Sometimes the way the temptations of Christ are presented, that is theoretically, it seems as though it was a piece of cake, nothing to it. And of course, in our day, with the emphasis on the deity of Christ, if you emphasize only the deity of Christ, then obviously God cannot be tempted with evil. So it is a piece of cake. You can say he was outwardly tempted, but there was no real struggle. I mean, objects capable of attracting him in the direction of enticement to moral evil were presented to him, but they didn't make any effect on him. They had no effect whatsoever. Well, that doesn't seem to fit with Hebrews 2:18 and Hebrews 4:15. Doesn't seem to quite grasp that, nor does it seem to fit with the Gethsemane scene at all. So, we've got to do something with this. Now, on page 5, the question of peccability or impeccability comes to the fore. And there's a chart that's referred to on the next page, the ability of various personal beings to sin and or not to sin. And at the bottom of that chart, which some of you have seen before in other contexts, you notice it gives the translation of the heads of the four columns there to the right. Posse pecare, able to sin. Non posse pecare, not able to sin. Posse non pecare, able not to sin. And non posse non pecare, not able not to sin. And then in the left hand, we have various personal beings, God, angels, Satan, demons, Adam and Eve before and after the fall, unregenerate persons on earth and hell, regenerate persons on earth and in heaven, Christ on earth and Christ in heaven. Now, it would take a fair amount of time to discuss each one of the blocks. That would be profitable. You understand, I'm not suggesting it wouldn't be profitable as an exercise. It would be. It would stretch your mind a little, make the little gray cells wake up and do a little exercise, but rather than do all that, which I'm sorry that we don't have the time to do, I'll just to get a feel for what's going on with those heads, what they mean. You notice the angels before the rebellion, that is, before their fall. They were able to sin and they were able to keep from sinning. And after the fall, they were not able to sin. That is, these are angels who did not fall, because otherwise they would go, in my scheme, two lines down into the heads of demons. I realize that some people distinguish between angels, fallen angels, and demons, but I lump those together as one category. So that fallen angels really come under demons. And these are angels after the fall, that is, those who are fallen. You understand? You may want to put a note into that effect. Demons are fallen angels in this chart. And so the angels before the rebellion and after the rebellion mean angels who are still angels after the fall. Tom.
What do you base your angels after the rebellion on? Why wouldn't they just stay the same? What has changed for them that they have changed categories? And why did you make the decision?
The question of whether angels still have the ability to sin following the fall is a nice question. So far as information that we have, which is very scarce, very precious, precious little, it would appear that this was a kind of a probation for them, and that those who did not keep their first estate, as Peter says, they fell and incurred condemnation, whereas those who did not continue on, and there's no indication that there's another probation for them, or that they have this situation which they had before the rebellion, which suggests the idea of angels, as is said and has been traditionally said, being confirmed in holiness, as the saints who are glorified are confirmed in holiness, so that there's never again another probation. Now, admittedly, it's building off certain assumptions, certain analogies, admittedly. So that's something that could use some further work. But for argument's sake, at least that's where it stands on this chart. Now, you notice that unregenerate persons on earth are able to sin and are not able not to sin. The same thing, unregenerate persons in hell. Regenerate persons on earth have the ability to sin and the ability not to sin. Now that looks as though they're adamant, like Adam and Eve before the fall. And someone may question that second column 3, Pose non peccare, as far as regenerate persons on earth. We have to discuss that under sanctification and perfection, and we'll try to break that up. It's too gross here, the way it's stated. It needs further refinement. You can't answer it just like that. You have to then go on and make qualifications. So understand that I'm making mental qualifications when I put it there. Notice, Christ in heaven, I have him not able to sin. But I haven't said anything about Christ on earth, and that's really what we need to ask. So, we'll keep that in mind as we proceed. Back to page 5. On page 5, number 2 raises some practical relevance issues. Was Christ able to sin even as we are able to sin, or was he not able to sin? Was he unable to sin, or able not to sin, or able to sin and able not to sin? That sounds like double talk. If in an absolute sense he was not able to sin, then were his temptations genuine? I mean, if a person cannot sin, then what does it mean to be tempted to sin? What does that mean? If a person doesn't have the ability to sin, what does it mean to be tempted? Not in the sense of tested to show the genuineness of character, but enticed to moral evil. That's the idea of tempted here. Pat. Well, of course, you've read the quotation from Shed, and that obviously colors our thinking. Yes. And I quoted Shed because I think it's such an excellent statement. In fact, I looked for years for a really good resolution of that problem, and when I read Shed, I rejoiced. I was really impressed with what Shed did. He was the only one of all the theologians that I read who had seemingly thought through the problem to a solution. And I like Shedd for that reason. Now, Shedd is a Southern Presbyterian, for all you Baptist people. He's a Southern Presbyterian, but Shedd has drawbacks. Not doctrinally so much as organizationally. I mean, it's horrendously organized. The chapters, the long chapters, aren't outlined at all. I mean, it's just a block of material, and you have to find your way all through it. It's terrible. I mean, if he had outlined, or somebody else had outlined it, it would have made it so much more useful. And then, as you've already seen, if you've looked at the chapters by Shedd, some chapters are well worked out, and some chapters are a page or two. And say hardly anything. So you get the idea that it's an uneven treatment. Still, I like Shedd because of the way he goes after the real problems and tackles them. He doesn't sidestep the problems. He goes after them. So Shedd has a lot to offer. Enough of a commercial. What about these scenarios? Are they at all analogous? If a person has lost his or her sight, can he or she be enticed to look at a pornographic picture? If they can't see, how can there be any temptation? If there's no ability, how can there be a temptation? If a security guard at the Pentagon has no access to military secrets at all, can he be enticed by an agent of a foreign power to sell such secrets? Suppose you have a very strong dislike of a particular food. Let's see, my daughter Kathy's number one dislike is coconut. I don't understand that myself. I like coconut. And number two is liver. The texture of it is what disturbs her. But if you have a very strong dislike, can you be enticed? I mean, I could never be enticed to liver myself. You see, I'm also. Come to my house. Yeah, you mean you could entice me? I think not. listen. People have been trying to get me to drink coffee for years. For years! And whenever I go to some pastor's home or go to some place where they have what they consider to be exceptional coffee, they always try to get me to try it. And, you know, in a moment of weakness, I'll try it, you know. It won't change anything, I know that, and it never has. I've tried to do everything to kill it, you know, cream, lots of sugar, still bitter. I can't be enticed with coffee, okay? Simply can't. The fourth one, if you go to Shady Maple Restaurant, and you eat so much that you're bursting, well, you know, it really doesn't, if somebody brings another whole sundae, you know, you make your own sundaes there, somebody brings another whole sundae, that doesn't appeal to me at all if I'm bursting. Yes, Tom.
Haven't you ever had the experience of looking at that food and just wanting to eat more, but you know you absolutely can't because you've tried, but looking at it, it's still, you know, like, oh, if only I could take it home, you know?
Well, I only do that when I think of later. You can't take doggy bags out of Shady Maple, but... And I think what a soupy mess it would be anyway, the ice cream, you know, later. So. No, if I really get... Well, I shouldn't say that because it sounds like I'm being committing one of the seven deadly sins here. I think. Gluttony. It sounds as though I'm, you know, so full that I can't look another thing in the eye. Yes, Scott.
Matthew 5, 29, 30 with the fourth, something like this, where Christ said, if your right eye causes you to sin, gouge it out. You know, or if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Not that he was saying to necessarily do that in a literal sense, but it sounded like he was saying that there were ways where you could cut short temptation by not looking, by not touching.
Mm-hmm.
Which would seem to indicate that if someone didn't have the ability to see, if someone didn't have the eye,
Thank you. So the question that I raise here, if in an absolute sense Christ was unable to sin, how can we identify with him? How can he identify with us? How can we identify with his temptations? How are they meaningful to us? If there was no real struggle, then how does that relate to my struggles with temptation? Question, did Christ have the genuine ability to sin with respect to his human nature, irrespective of his divine nature and God's plan? Now, the next chart takes up that question. The chart entitled The God-Man, Peccable or Impeccable. Which again I filled in, excuse me. Was Christ able to be tested? Did he have normal human needs and appetites? Was he able to be attracted to objects capable of meeting normal human needs and appetites? Was Christ, that should be was, the punching knocked out the was Christ inwardly inclined towards sin? That is, did he have a sinful nature? Did Christ have sinful desires? Was he able to be enticed to sin? Now that's the crucial one. Was he able to commit sin? Did he commit acts of sin? The last two are different, by the way. Able to sin and actually committing acts of sin are not the same. So now I've divided these columns with respect to the decrees of God. Was he able to be tested with respect to the decrees of God? Speaking now of God's plan. God's plan. Was that testing, in other words, included in the plan of God? Was he able to be tested? So I've answered yes. With respect to his divine nature alone, was he able to be tested? I say yes. Tested. Not enticed to moral evil, but tested, okay? With respect to his human nature alone, was he able to be tested so as to bring out his his true character? Yes. As the one person, the God-man? Yes. Did he have normal needs and appetites? Yes. With respect to his divine nature alone, I haven't included that. I've shaded it out because it says that he had normal human needs, okay? So it doesn't apply. Human needs, divine nature. Human needs refers, of course, to his human nature. With respect to his human nature alone, yes. As the one person, yes. Was he able to be attracted to objects capable of meeting normal human needs and appetites? Yes, yes, yes. Was he inwardly inclined towards sin? Did he have a sinful nature? Contrary to Karl Barth's suggestion that Christ took our human corruption into himself so as to become fully human, the answer here is no. He did not have a sinful nature. Of course, we can't separate the nature of a person from what a person does. Christ himself taught us that a person does what he or she is. There's a real connection there between character and conduct. And I suggest no with respect to his human nature alone, and no as the one person. Did he have sinful desires? I've suggested no. Was he able to be enticed to sin? Yes, with respect to the decrees of God. For example, the plan of God surely included the experience of being drawn out into the wilderness and enticed to evil by Satan. During those 40 days in the wilderness, he was continually being enticed to moral evil. With respect to his divine nature alone, was he able to be enticed to sin? No. God cannot be tempted with evil. James chapter 1. With respect to his human nature alone, there's the crucial question, and I suggest yes. With respect to his human nature alone, I suggest he was able to be enticed to sin. And as the one person, the God-man, I answer yes there because he was not only divine, but he was human. So I can say, yes, the one person, with respect to his human nature, was able to be enticed to sin. If I said the one person with respect to his divine nature, I'd have to say no. And I've already said it there in that column. Was he able to commit sin? No, no. And I suggest here, with respect to his human nature alone, he was able to sin. With respect to his human nature alone. By able here, I mean he had everything necessary, all the abilities necessary in his human nature to sin. He didn't have inward lust. He didn't have inward enticement. He didn't have inward echo to outward. But he was different from us in that respect, because we always have an echo chamber that operates. When we have an outward enticement, we're drawn away, James said, by our own lusts and enticed. We always have an inward echo to the outward occasion of enticement to moral evil. So I suggest, with respect to his human nature alone, Christ was able to commit sin. But with respect to him as a person, and here Pat mentioned before, and we alluded to Shedd's resolution of that, no. Why? Because, once again, his divine nature could allow his human nature to be ignorant of certain things, could allow his human nature to be present only somewhere, could allow his human nature to know only certain things, and to have only limited power, but his divine nature could not permit him, with respect to his human nature, to sin. Scott.
Seems like maybe there's some difference between being enticed to sin and being able to sin.
that as the one person, the God-man, yes, he is able to be enticed, but then with respect to his human nature.
Yes. Yes. I have to say that because he operates as a person.
Right. So I'm not sure why you don't say yes in this column as able to sin with respect to his human nature.
Oh. You're right. I am doing two different things.
If you're going to say no here, then I would think the one above should be no also.
Yes, that's correct. Especially since under the column with respect to his divine nature alone, I said no. Yes, Gwen.
But that would have had definite difference because the first one was Christ able to do saying yes with respect to his human nature, because we can affirm from his human nature that he's able to do it. We have no proof that he did commit acts of sin. Ask the question, did Christ commit acts of sin? We need scriptural proof. That's not a difference. That's not something to draw off an inference. That you need scriptural proof.
I'm not talking about the last one. I'm talking about the
he's saying not the last line, but the next to the last and next to the next to the last, those two lines.
So where?
Well, Scott suggested if I proceed on the basis I did, Christ was not able to commit sin as the one person, the God-man. He was not able simply because he could not permit himself with respect to his human nature to sin. He could permit himself to be ignorant, but not to sin, because that gets into a moral issue. Then, why did I not go to a different procedure and ground when I looked at the column or the line above that and say yes as the one person? Why did I not say no there? Was he able to be enticed to sin? That is, the two, if I'm talking about with respect to his human nature, should seem to go together. They should seem to have the same answer. Either yes in both or no in both. If I'm proceeding on a similar basis. Bill, yes, further. Gwen. Okay, you tell me.
I agree with your chart. I don't understand Scott's question.
Okay. Scott, could you sharpen the question for Gwen?
Okay. The row, was Christ able to be enticed to sin?
Right.
And the column, as the one person, the God-man, the answer is yes, and it was conditioned by saying yes with respect to his human nature, because obviously with respect to his divine nature, it says no there.
Yeah.
So the answer yes in the last column is with respect to his human nature alone, and does not take into account his divine nature, or does not qualify by the idea of his divine nature. Then the next row down, again we have no with respect to his divine nature, he was not able to commit sin, but we have yes with respect to his human nature, he was able to commit sin. Therefore, to be consistent with the way the row above was handled, I would submit that either it should be yes, as the one person, the God-man, was able to commit sin with respect to his human nature, or those two should both be no. There seems to be a lack of consistency as to applying, as to how the answer is.
Scott, is it the line, was Christ able to be enticed to sin, and the last column, should that column properly be split into no and yes? No with respect to his divine nature, yes with respect to his human nature. And then the next line down, was Christ able to commit sin, the column as the one person, the God-man, should that be no as a bottom line no? In other words, the bottom line of the whole thing is no. What do you think of that, Scott?
I'm uncomfortable about dividing it because,
okay.
Because we're talking about as for one person. How do you call it two answers for one person? Maybe I'm just running against a paradox here, which is the paradox of Christ's human and divine nature.
Yes. Probably the way you can come up with the two answers for the one person is because in the column with respect to his divine nature alone, I put no, and with respect to his human nature, I put yes. And it sounds as though when you put those together, you do have a no and a yes. It sounds as though I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth.
Yeah.
Which I would hope I'm not doing, but it's possible, you know. David, and then Bill, and then...
Well, if we're comparing Psalms or whatever, I was looking over the respect to God's plan, and it seems to follow more along those lines than it does on one perspective's line or human. In according to God's plan, you're able to be enticed, yes, but according to God's plan, he is not able to convince him. So,
right.
Maybe it doesn't take any
and that's probably why I suggested the bottom line idea under was Christ able to commit sin? As far as his mission is concerned in the plan and purpose of God, he was not able to commit sin. That would have ruined his mission, obviously. Really? Oh, splendid, Bill.
I think you have to read, was Christ able to be enticed to sin as God man? I think you have to read that, yes. And let the other stand with that. The reason, the very thrust of the incarnation is God identifying with man.
Yes.
And I mean, I think that in the end, some men would say to God, you don't know what it's like.
Yeah.
And God said, oh yes, I do. Yeah. And demonstrate that. And yeah. He said, to cut the grass from under that, from a judicial standpoint.
Right. Thanks. Yes.
That total identification so that the Hebrews passage talks about an identification with that has to make sense on the ground of being really here. God being really here. God knowing what it's really like to feel what we feel.
Maybe that's where I'm caught, Scott, in that tension. Jack.
First and third columns should be connected as they are in the third and last row. So maybe you should have a yes in each. Because there is a sense, again, maybe you need to split the first row into two.
The first column?
Yeah.
The first column? With respect to the decrees of God?
Yeah, with respect to the human nature or divine nature, because you're saying, it seems to be inconsistent or logical to say that not, well, what's he going to sin in respect to, commit sin in respect to, if he, as a human, is not in respect to his
I think so.
Yeah. So let's put that one.
When?
I think that's what he's asking there, was what Christ will commit sin, you have to know that he's not common with respect to. The question of obedience is, what's Christ able to commit sin? That's what you're asking there. That the one of us, because the one of us is yes, with respect to the truth of God, to have a fully obedient Christ,
if you just take the third column of him and say, with respect to human nature alone, he can sin, or he's able to sin. Now, was he able to sin with respect to has to be the priest of God? Then you have to go back to the first one and say, with respect to the priest of God, he must be able to sin. So, what is he going to sin against? Except for the priest of God. So, it seems like if three is yes, you have to do more. So, I'm sure, like, has to.
You know, it's tricky. You put your finger on an important philosophical point. It's tricky when you say, was Christ able to commit sin? The word able, the word can, is a very tricky word in philosophy. Very tricky. Well, for instance, although I've mentioned this illustration before, I had the privilege of having a J. Oliver Buswell Jr. for one semester in systematic theology. And Dr. Buswell said, he says, can I beat my wife? Yes, I believe I can. I believe I can. He says, but can I beat my wife? He says, no, I can't beat my wife. He warned us that the word can is a very tricky word. And when we say, was he able to commit sin? You can be talking about the ability, or you can be talking about the potential to actually commit the act. And those are two different things. And it's tricky because, see, Jack, I think you're talking about the ability. And you want to make that clear, because as soon as you say yes in the third column with respect to human nature alone, you think, hey, if there's a yes there, then certainly that's included in the plan and purpose of God. So you've got to have a yes somewhere in that first column, opposite was Christ able to commit sin, somewhere in there. And I guess, see now, Jack suggests these two answers, yes and no. But the yes, I think, would be in regard to this question of ability, and the no in regard to the potential to actually do it. Potentiality in respect to actuality. And I know that gets very tricky.
But also, I think, just in purely in regard to what he's going to sin against, it's the decrees of God, so that's what I'm saying. That seems to be the thrust of the first question.
Okay, Pat. See, that's why I said yes in the third column with respect to his human nature alone. Was he able to commit sin? Not only that reason, but also the genuineness of the temptations. The genuineness of the struggle with temptation. When you look at the scene in the Garden of Gethsemane, that doesn't look like play acting. I mean, there's no way to read that account without feeling deeply that Christ was going through a tremendous struggle. And what was the enticement? Not to go to the cross. That was the enticement. Not to finish the work. Not to complete the atonement. When? It was a controlled response. Yeah.
I guess that's what I'm trying to say. Is that in that area of sin, there was no taking of life. There absolutely should have been or could have been given the humanity of the situation.
Yeah.
I mean, I just know how angry I get because I'm a little bit angry. I'm a little bit angry. I would love to get away from that. Thank you. I'll consider that. Yes, you're wrong. Well, I think... Yes. Obviously not clearly. No, well, I have to unpack that further, obviously, to make that distinction clear. The wording would have to be worked out very carefully.
Almost as if the ability to commit sin is almost the same as the ability to be enticed. In the first sense that you mentioned, it's the ability to do it as opposed to the potential to actually commit it. I mean, you have like someone like Luke Rigney who has the ability to punch me in the stomach and really do me some damage, but you know, maybe he's a nice enough guy, you know, I hope that he would not have the potential to actually do that if he met me on the street.
So even if we substituted for ability, capability, we'd still have to distinguish between, in that case, say, the physical capability of the Incredible Hulk, if you wish, and the and a tendency or propensity which came from within in that direction, which arises from, say, disposition of character or something like that, which you would hope would not be in that direction, lest the propensity erupt and employ the physical capability to hurt you. Yes, they will.
That's a proper distinction. That's already made. I'm talking about Christ's name.
The,
so our ability here, I think, must be potential to actually do this.
Oh, in other words, you think I've already included the two meanings in the chart. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, that's worthy consideration. Bill?
Well, that's the real thrust of Roswell. And can I leave my wife back?
Yeah.
You know, great to ask you questions.
Yes.
Appropriately.
Yeah.
And
okay. Good. Thank you, Leroy. Okay. Is it time for a break? Okay. Let's hold it to 21 after, shall we?